Hello, I'm Kara Dahl-Russell, and as you know, we're interested here at WSEL not just in music, but the arts in general. And just a couple weeks ago, I was very fortunate to meet in his home habitat Al Calderaro, director of Gallery A in Richmond, Virginia, 114 A Virginia Street. The Shaco Design District is what it's starting to be called. Hi, Al.
Hi, Kara.
Good to talk to you again. Thanks for spending some time with us and telling us about the life of a gallery director. Off the line, you were just about to tell me a little bit about the building you're in and the district you're in, Gallery A.
Well, the district was is primarily or historically known as Shaco Slip. The older buildings in this area, such as the one that the gallery is in, were warehouses, tobacco warehouses primarily, but also coffee warehouses. And the reason it was called Shaco Slip is because there was a slip for cargo boats to come up the river and unload their cargo, and then they would bring them to the warehouses.
And it reminded me when I was there of a lot of districts kind of in New York or in D.C., any sort of an old town district that's undergone a kind of a bohemian renovation and where a lot of arts happenings are starting to develop, and your gallery is part of that, I take it.
It is, and one of the reasons I've wound up taking the space and putting a gallery here is because I lived in Tribeca in New York back when it was still a warehouse district, and so I was part of that kind of conversion from light industrial to arts district, and the building that I lived in is the same age as the building that I'm now in. So they were both kind of immediately after Civil War vintage, cast iron fronts, wood frames, heavy wooden timbers. So it was kind of what I was used to or what I liked, or maybe it was because it reminded me of my youth. And somebody asked me if I wanted to put a gallery in here, and I said, what the heck? And that's how I got here.
And I must say, it's because of the age of the building and probably the previous uses of the building, it's an interesting structure itself, and I think you've used it beautifully for the show that I saw. Why don't we back up a little bit? What was your formal arts education?
Well, I went to, for graduate school, in undergraduate school, I wound up getting a history degree with a minor in art. And then for graduate school, the way I first came to Richmond was I went to VCU. To graduate school, and I have a MFA in sculpture. But I actually never did very much sculpture. I became a painter. And when I was in New York, I was primarily painting. That's how I first came to Richmond, and that's kind of how I got into art. Although I grew up right outside of New York City and started going into the city, which is what people who live in that area call Manhattan. That is the city. And kind of hanging out in the village, and then when Soho started happening, going down to Soho, and the school that I went to in New Jersey, the art teachers primarily all lived in Manhattan, and so I started hanging out with them and going over to Soho. So I was kind of in and on the ground floor of Soho, so to speak.
Why don't you take the time here to describe your work and also some of the people that were around in the scene when you were there in New York?
It was actually a very happening time. My work is The category it would fall into is pop art. And they're kind of...
Good. That's what I would have called it, but I'm glad to hear it from you. So.
You're right.
And plus, I've only seen one of your works, so...
Well, that one's fairly typical, in some ways maybe quintessential, especially of my earlier paintings. Very American. The one that you saw that I'm currently looking at is a... sort of a Marilyn Monroe figure, but it's got elements of all kinds of pop culture.
And M&Ms.
M&Ms and McDonald's and references to all these other very American institutions.
And the scene while you were working in New York?
The scene was, I was just talking to somebody today about that, how it was a very kind of special time. It was just very dynamic.
And did you say that was about the time that Warhol was there?
Yes, he was. Actually, I had dinner with Andy Warhol. Did I tell you that story?
No, but that sounds like the name of a play.
Yes, I did. I had dinner with Andy Warhol and had one time had a drink with Mick and Bianca Jagger. So Mick comes over to the table. We all shake hands. Mick and Bianca sit down. We're all talking. And then Halston comes over to the table. Then Divine. Remember Divine?
Yes.
Pink Flamingos. Divine came over to the table. And now everybody starts figuring out they're not anybody. And the slowly kind of drifted away. But it was fun. And so that's the scene.
So that was the scene. That sort of wraps it all up.
That's what it was like. Yes, it was, you know, and then the next day I'd be back on the truck delivering art.
You said you had a lot of other side jobs to support your art habit. Were you showing at all at that time?
That was probably just before I had my first sort of break. But it was around that time. And I think my first real New York exposure came after that, by maybe a year or so. But it was, you know, I was a part of the scene. There was the young art scene, and I was working at, you know, many jobs. But I was a studio assistant to Gordon Matta Clark, who was his father was a famous painter, Matta. But he was at that point getting pretty well known, and his work was he actually cut up buildings and then photographed them. So his sculpture was kind of taking a building that was just about to be knocked down, and he'd start cutting like arcs and triangles and letting the sun shine through. And I worked on that crew, so it was kind of like, you know, construction or demolition, but also worked in his studio and helping him do his art, actually kind of doing some of it for him. Since he cut up the buildings, he really didn't have work that you could sell. But his dealer, who was Holly Solomon, basically suggested that he do something that she could sell. And so he started doing these drawings, which were big stacks of paper bolted together. And then we would cut out like arcs and some of the same shapes that he would cut out in the buildings in the paper. And that was my job. I cut them out, partly to make them more interesting for me. I would start changing them, cutting out different shapes. And he came in and said, "Oh, that looks good. Let's go with it." Anyway, that's how I met Holly Solomon, who was my first art dealer.
And that gives people sort of a sense of the roundabout way that these things happen in the business, through a friend that invites you to an opening, or working with someone that it gets you in contact with someone else. Now, was that before you then went back for your master's in Virginia?
No, I had actually finished all the studio work for the master's before I went to New York. But I was, you know, young, and at that point I said, well, you know, I'm just going to New York. I'm going to be famous. I don't need a master's degree. Then a couple of years after I got to New York, they asked me if I wanted to do my thesis show, which I did. It was a painting show. That's for my MFA in sculpture, which was kind of shocking to some of the painting professors. But that was in the early days of VCU, when it was a lot more, I guess the expression would be, a little looser than it is today.
And speaking of VCU, am I correct that the show that you have going in your gallery right now is one of the professors there?
Yes, actually, one of the first sculpture professors hired by VCU when they became VCU. It was the merger of two different schools here in Richmond.
And for people here who might not know VCU, that stands for?
Virginia Commonwealth University. It is now the number one Newsweek-rated public art program in the country. But when I went here, it was unknown completely. So the artist who's now showing here, Myron Helfgott, was one of the people who was hired at the beginning when it was basically nothing, and was part of taking the program from nothing to number one. He was actually chairman of the department for a couple of years before he retired. Now retired, but he kind of saw the whole metamorphosis, which is now, you know, becoming a research institute and all these other kinds of things. It's interesting for me because in a way I've sort of been part of the whole process. I came in at the beginning, and now I'm back here in Richmond and sort of, you know, showing people who either work there or do work there, or we've had some student graduate shows here.
Tell me about the show that's going now. What was his name again?
Myron Helfgott. He is, as I said, a sculptor, but the work is combines photography with sculptural elements, in that he builds these large structures and then puts photographs on them, but also wants you to see the structure. So the photograph will usually be on, for lack of a better term, the front, and then the structure is open. So if you walk around the sculpture, you'll be able to see the structure that's holding the photograph. Although he doesn't refer to that as the back, it's the other side.
which, having seen it, I understand. Sometimes the frames are multi-layered, and then there seems to be a recurring theme of either death or the fading of beauty, in which there would be, say, a picture of a hibiscus bush on a frame that sort of gives the picture, a shape of the hibiscus bush, and behind that is the decayed, dead hibiscus bush.
Yes, it's the hibiscus that he photographed when it was in flower is part of the piece, except that it's now dead. So yeah, it's kind of cycle of life themes.
And I actually think this show would have a lot of interest for various people. I think photographers would be interested, but also I think anyone who does woodwork would be interested, because these frames that he's created are really marvelously crafted and beautiful.
Yes. Well, he started out as an architecture student. He went to architecture school for 2 years before he went to school for sculpture, and also studied for a couple of summers with Buckminster Fuller, a name that was at one time pretty well known. Yeah, so he has a training in architecture, and is actually a very interesting person. But his work is terrific, in my opinion.
Now, I met you with my friend who's a sculptor and artist, John Antone, who works internationally, as well as I think you represent him or have a couple of his pieces. You were saying that you just sort of fell into being the director and curator of the gallery. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Oh, well, the primary way that I support myself these days is I appraise commercial real estate. And one of my clients, who then became a friend, is the managing partner of this building that I'm in. It's about 3 years ago now. I quit doing appraisals and just went back to painting, wanted to paint. And my friend was obviously concerned about my sanity at that point. And one day called me and said, let's go out and have lunch. And so we went to lunch. He started talking to me about various scenarios. He has a management development company, and they were thinking about starting an appraisal division. Wanted to know if I wanted to head it, and I said, no, I don't want to do any more appraisals. And so we went through several things. And finally says, well, I have this space that would make a great art gallery. And I said, well, I don't really want an art gallery either. I just want to paint. I don't want to be a gallery owner. And he said, well, it's an interesting space, and it also has an office in case you want to do real estate appraisals again. And I said, well, I don't want to do that either. He said, let's look at it. And so we came over, and we walked in, and I looked at it, and I said, oh, wow, this is great.
And it is great. It's a great space.
It really is. I mean, the art looks good here. Not that the art isn't good anyway, but it really looks good here.
Yeah, and the place itself has interesting levels and openings.
Yes, it's the way it's kind of laid out, it makes a good art gallery. And so I walked in and I said, wow, it looks like an art gallery, and it looks like from Tribeca. And I said, not only that, but I have a whole bunch of paintings, so I can just put up a show. I can do a show. And I'll paint it white, I'll put up the show, and I figured, I actually said, what the hell? And that's kind of the theme of the gallery.
And
what the hell?
You told us you really thought you'd only be there for a couple months initially. Was that right?
Yes, we're now on, the people that were here in the beginning, friends and supporters. I said, okay, well, I think what we should do is, like, we'll just go with, like, the first show was last show number one. And now we're on last show, I think it's number 13 or 14. So the part of our philosophy here is how high can we push that number? You know, I'd like to get to the last show, 1,000 or something like that. And that also says something about the art business. It's very kind of ephemeral, how to keep it all going. And, I'm still doing commercial real estate appraisals.
Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to me that you mentioned you sort of had this period where you just wanted to get back to painting. And I think anyone who's been in the arts for a while, you do sort of go through phases with things, I think, where you want to move in this direction for no ostensible reason. It's just, it's been a while and you want to get back to that.
Yeah, you have to sort of reconnect. It's a very compelling feeling. It's hard not to do it. Mm-hmm. You really kind of, for me anyway, it's almost like physical. You kind of have to do this or else you feel like you're going to explode. So you kind of have to get back to it and reconnect. And it's actually enabled me to continue doing the real estate appraisals, which is something I can get paid for, mm-hmm. because I'm doing that to support the gallery, basically, at this point. We do sell work, but not as much as I would like, and not enough to sort of pay the bills. So it's kind of made it, it's changed my attitude about doing real estate appraisals, because now I'm sort of doing it for this other purpose.
Well, and thank you for being frank about that, because that's what I think is the important part of these interviews, is especially for, say, students that are interested in pursuing the wacky world of life in the arts. It's important to know that people with a diverse background, and even with, you know, the formal credentials, you often have to do other things or combine things in new ways that suit your life to keep it together.
You have to figure out a way to make it work. As I used to, when I was teaching, I used to tell the students, people who become artists because they can't not do it. Because if you can figure out some other way to make a living or something else you're happy doing, you will probably do that.
Most other things are easier.
unless you're passionate about what you're doing, it's pretty hard to keep it together, because you're always doing these other things to pay the rent. And so you can keep doing the work. You know, if you don't have that sort of the classical way to say it is the passion, but it's almost more like a compulsion to do the art or to participate in whatever your art form is, music, performance, that really kind of makes it possible for you to do the other things that you have to do to survive, because you have this other purpose and that keeps you going. I mean, I had so many different jobs when I was in New York, but you see yourself as an artist, and so you don't see the fact that you, and this is something I've done, that you're sanding a 3,500 square foot loft floor to make mm-hmm. the money to pay the rent. You don't see yourself as a floor sander. Not that being a floor sander is a bad thing. It's just that you're doing that because you've got a painting that you want to work on, and you've got to pay the rent on your studio, and it kind of makes it work. But it's not something you would really, if you were completely sane, probably pick.
Oh, I think that's the hardest thing for people who are not driven to work on the arts to understand, is that for most of our society, you're defined by your job, and you're defined by the job that pays the rent. And for artists, often the job that pays the rent is very far from the things that you use to define yourself.
Yeah, it's a means to an end. Mm-hmm. You know, also wind up having, you know, some fairly interesting jobs, but they would not be things that you would think of as a career.
We had a side conversation that I wanted to be able to share with people. You were talking about the people that do buy art, and I think you were particularly talking about corporate buyers or the large-scale buyers, that they have kind of a tiered way of looking at the art that they purchase. Can you kind of unwrap that concept for us a bit?
Well, I mean, the corporate situation that they're buying work for, they have considerations that a private collector wouldn't have, because it's going to go in a public space. So, and I don't know if this is what you're referring to, but...
Well, I think you were particularly talking about someone who sort of has all three. They have an art space, they have corporate spaces, and they have personal collection.
Well, typically what would happen there is that personal collections are much more free-ranging in the subject matter. And the corporate stuff is, they'll have rules. It can't have political content. It can't have sexual content, because they're going to be in places where the public is going to walk in, and what they don't want is to offend people or freak people out or, you know, those kinds of things. But in their private collection, they will buy whatever they want. So for the most part, the private stuff tends to be much more expensive, because it's going to be in a much more contained location, secure, and then ultimately will probably go to a museum as part of their collection, if it's a big enough collector. Mm-hmm.
It was fascinating to me that you mentioned that some of these collectors, even if they like something, if they have an eye towards donating to a museum later, when they bequeath it somewhere, that they will sometimes check in with the larger museums first.
Yes, they will, especially for things like sculpture, which is harder to store and generally harder to deal with than a painting. If it's a big purchase, and if it's something that they're going to include in their donation to the museum, before they buy it, they will check with the museum to, you know, see if it's something the museum's going to want. Otherwise, it just becomes a storage issue. Of course, it depends on the work, whose it is, and if it's somebody who's really famous, like investment-grade art, for example, a Warhol or a Jasper Johns, there's usually not a problem with getting somebody to take that. But some, you know, lesser-known artists or some maybe difficult work in some way, either content or physically difficult to deal with, they will check in first. It makes sense. I mean, it's sort of a, you know, one of the interesting things about art, and I think most things that people do. When you get in it, you start understanding how many different levels there are, how many different sort of worlds within this world are there. It's really pretty interesting. For years, the whole thing with kind of running a gallery, for years I was just an artist. So I was on like one side of the desk. And now that I'm on the other side of the desk, I start seeing things from another perspective. And you start figuring out this whole other area that you didn't really think about much before.
Has it changed your work?
Not really, because since I've started the gallery, I haven't really done much painting. I don't have time, but I'm sure it will. And it probably in selection of subject matter, for one thing. Actually, what I found is being sort of everything, owner, director, curator at the gallery, like hanging the shows and putting the things together and picking the work, is actually pretty creative. And it sort of, for now, is kind of covering my artistic urge.
Mm-hmm.
And I've sort of gotten into that. You know, how do you put it together? What looks good where? What pieces go together? And not necessarily are they match or are they similar, but do they work together? Especially when you're doing a group show and you've got four or five people in the show and the work is really all different. How do you make that work? And I found that to be pretty creative and fun and mm-hmm. interesting. And, you know, just learning how to deal with artists is pretty interesting.
From the other side of the desk.
Yes, from the other side of the desk, and remembering some of my experiences with my dealers, now seeing it through a different set of eyes. I guess I don't have any children, but I guess parents have this experience, remembering what they were like when they were children and now having to deal with their own children, you know, having these sort of deja vu moments, but like from the other side. So it's been kind of interesting.
Getting back to the collectors, do you think that it's always been that way, that collectors checked to see how things were valued, or is it a myth that there are these collectors that just get what they love, or is that sort of an old way and collectors have started being more forward-looking in terms of where they're going to leave it?
No, there are collectors who just buy what they like, and they have enough money, or they have enough self-confidence to just do it. And there are people who just collect what they love, and they just love art.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's another kind of multi-layered situation. You know, buying artwork, especially if it's difficult or new or not yet recognized as art, takes some guts, not just money, because if you buy a very new or very possibly controversial painting and put it up in your house or put it up in your office, you're going to wind up having to defend that decision somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So you can either just be so confident that you don't care what anybody thinks, or you're so knowledgeable that you can explain exactly why you bought it, or you have such a great sense of the market and where it's headed that you paid $5,000 for it and next year it's going to be worth $50,000.
I would think that would be the hardest way to buy, wouldn't it?
Yes. We were talking about back in New York, one of the things that made New York so great back then or in that period was that there was a huge speculative art market where people were doing that. They were out, you know, prospecting for artists. The way the market was is that you would buy something for $5,000 and the next year it would be worth $50,000. So it was great for the artists because a lot of people were getting opportunities. But it's not quite that way anymore. So the money was really kind of getting spread around, which is good for art.
Mm-hmm.
Having just a few like really famous people who make millions of dollars is not so good for having a vibrant art scene, because the more people that can sort of survive, the better it is.
Mm-hmm.
But everything changes, so.
I think we're probably due for another round of that. I think at the same time that was going on in the fine arts, that was going on in film and theater, and now everything's a little more corporatized in some ways. There are very little risks taken, and I think we're due for another groundswell change.
Yeah, well, and part of that is because there's, you know, when the money involved to either produce things or buy things is so huge, you know, risk becomes very risky. People are less willing to take a chance, so they become more cautious about what they're doing. They become less or more risk averse. My feeling is that we're maybe on at the beginning of a change in that, where you start figuring out how to do things differently, so that the investment in cash is lower, but there's more of a reward because you're actually taking a different kind of risk.
Mm-hmm.
If you become more willing to take a chance in different ways, you also see the opportunities lay in other areas. You know, the internet has changed that. You can be other places and still get your message out there in some way.
And definitely get seen and get your work seen for fine artists. I'm so appreciative of you taking time to talk to us. I've been talking with Al Calderaro.
That's it.
Director of Gallery A in Richmond, Virginia, in the Shaco Design District, currently showing the work of...
Myron Helfgott.
And that show will be up for how much longer now?
April 20th is the last day.
Interesting show, worth seeing if you're in the Richmond area. That's 114A Virginia Street. It was great meeting you a couple weeks ago. Thank you so much for taking the time to share some of your insight from multifaceted angles on the art scene with us, Al.
Well, thank you. It's been very interesting. It's always interesting to talk to people who are interested in art in all its many forms and also fellow artists.
Thanks, Al.
Bye. Thanks.